Welcome to Funded By Plus Impact. Today we're live at the Bloxup Recording Studio, and we're joined by Miguel Heise, CEO of Plant Jammer. So first of all, thank you so much for coming. It's such a pleasure hosting you.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Always. So first off, right off the bat, tell me a bit about Plant Jammer, what it is, and what's your mission?
Yeah, as we help people cook. It's very simple that way. You know, you have a food industry that's been spending the last 50 years telling people, if you cook, you know, you're probably going to mess up, so buy this product.
Yeah.
Right, and we're doing the opposite. We're actually telling people where you can cook, and you need a few tricks, and then you can cook different things every day and make something exciting. And we believe that if we can empower them in doing so, they will also do all the things that's good for themselves and the planet.
Yeah.
So we help them stop food waste, we help them eat more greens, eat less meat, because it's better for themselves and the planet.
Yes, and there is really a focus on vegetarian cooking, right, in your app or...
Okay. Exactly. So we started off saying, you know, what are the actions you can do as an individual that can make for a more sustainable planet? And one of the big ones is the way you eat. And one of the big fun things within eating is reducing your meat consumption. Mm. We don't believe in, you know, religion. We don't believe that you should necessarily go vegan. It's great if you do, but you don't have to. I don't. Mm-hmm. But if you can just, you know, reduce your meat consumption once a week or twice a week or four times a week, that would be great.
Yeah. And it started off, how many, was it 4 years ago now?
Yeah, right, 2016.
And it was, the original idea was an app, right? And it still is at the moment, an app.
Yeah, so exactly. So we started off with saying, you know, we want to just empower people and we're going to create an app for that because that can, you know, reach a billion people. Yes. I think along the way we've learned that, you know, the product itself is going well. We had a little bit more than a million downloads, a bit more than 150,000 active users, so it's going well. But we also realized we're probably not going to reach 1 billion people this way, and we want to impact the way a billion people eat. Mm. So we also packaged the API, so the database that makes the app, and we're now supplying that to businesses to make their own recipe experiences based on our technology.
Yes.
So that we can have all those distribution channels with our technology, so we can touch that billion people.
And that's a recent development, actually, right? We are going to get into that because it's also tied to your new funding round, I believe, with the Miel in Dr. Oetker.
Yeah,
that's correct. I think we always had it in the strategy.
Okay,
to be honest, it's happening now, also after the funding round, but it was always part of our pitch deck.
Okay,
it was always part
all
of
all the way
our
from the beginning, actually.
No.
Okay.
we do not. I did not wake up one morning and just have like, this is what's gonna happen in 4 years.
No.
So it was a learning experience. We got to that, but
okay.
I think it's at least 1.5 years ago that we realized that this was the right direction to go if we're gonna have the impact we wanted.
All right. So can you tell us about your funding journey so far? Because we really want to get closer to that, get some transparency, hear from you, a bit of your insights, and how's it been?
Yeah, I think it's been a little bit textbook, meaning that, you know, it started off with I had a fine corporate job, worked in McKinsey and then Novozymes, so I had a bit of cash, so I could sort of start off building something, which was like, you know, find someone on Upwork in Bangladesh who could build a website for $5,000.
All right, thing, right? Yeah.
But got enough to sort of show someone this is what I'm doing, and then the first thing you go for is, you know, friends, families, and fools, as they say.
Yeah.
So the first thing was a few friends I trusted and believed in, not fools.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a few angel investors in from the quite early stage to sort of get us through sort of somewhat of a product market fit. So we had 3 angel investors early. People who trusted me, basically, said, okay, Michael, I kind of believe in what you're doing, but also I believe in you, that you can sort of make something happen.
Yeah.
Did you know them or personally?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So one was a former colleague of mine from McKinsey, who I worked with. We were sort of in the trenches together back then.
Yeah.
It's actually Christian Arnstedt, was also in Løvenskog.
All right, yeah.
And then there were some other people I sort of come on along the way with a similar vision for where we wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that to get to a certain sort of degree of product market fit. And then at some point we needed like more cash to build this. You know, people get this wrong sometimes. A tech product is not cheap to build.
No.
It's almost as expensive as building a mine or a factory.
Yeah. So I think that's a wake-up call a lot of people are getting in the tech industry. Yeah.
They think it's just, if I have an idea, then it's always an app almost. Yeah. No. So you need some cash. So what we did along the way was getting corporate partners in. Because we realized early that, you know, actually there are a lot of people who are in line with our vision. Mm-hmm. And who are invested in companies like ours succeeding. So we started identifying those bigger companies and got them involved.
Yeah.
The particular two examples being Miele, the big kitchen equipment player, mm-hmm. And Dr. Oetker, who's in the food space in general.
Yeah,
you might not just know them from Shake and Bake and frozen pizzas, but they do a lot more.
And that's, would you say, because it's a little bit specific to your case, maybe this approaching corporate investors, I would say the more regular route is for early stage startups to go to first angel and then VCs, etc. But how did you go about this approaching corporate investors? Is it very different from angels or VCs? Or
it definitely is. I think the way we went about it was basically we started off because we had this vision of saying we want to partner with companies that win where we win. That's a general great question for yourself mm-hmm. to ask as a startup is, if we win, who wins? Because those are probably both good partners, but also good investors. And that's how it started. So we thought, you know, if we win, then people cook more. There's going to be a kitchen. Yeah. So that means people who make kitchen equipment and stuff like this, like Miele, they will be winning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, if people continue to not just do takeaway in restaurants, but cook at home, they're also going to need convenient products around that. So that's companies like Dr. Oetker, right? Mm-hmm. And that sort of got us to conversation with these companies about our product. So talking about, you know, what can we do? And then as we are talking about that, you see the glimmer in their eye about, you know, this is actually something we've been trying to build for years and couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it starts going from a customer conversation to an investor conversation. So it's really been that way. We didn't look for funding mm-hmm. in any of these cases. We were looking for customers, and they happened to be so excited as customers that they wanted to be investors.
Okay. So it kind of flipped the relationship throughout time, basically.
You could say it's the 2.0 version of a customer. It's a customer who's so excited about what they're getting that they want to invest in you getting even more customers getting this amazing product, right?
Yeah.
So it is sort of almost the pinnacle of a happy customer.
I would imagine if I was a startup approaching a corporate investor, I think the power is a little bit stronger in them maybe shaping the product how they want it to serve them, right? How did you go about that, actually?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an ongoing debate. It's something I've been saying from day one, and we've been, debating about from day one as well, that, you know, it's super important that we build something that is creating a scalable solution for the world, not just for them.
Yeah.
And that goes for investors, but it also goes generally when you're going B2B, that if you're selling to a company, you know, the bigger the ticket size becomes of that company, meaning how much they can pay for your product, the more they will also are more likely to want some sort of personalization and tailoring. And the more you tailor it for a particular case, the less scalable it is. So that trade-off will always be there. And that's the danger of both getting investors in who are big, but also getting customers in. And you need to be super specific and draw a clear line in the sand of, like, you know, this is the format of our corporation.
Yeah.
You're investing in us because you believe in what we're doing, so you should not change what we're doing. And you're believing investing in us as a team, so you should also trust in the team and what we're deciding. And that has to be super clear. I think it's a very common that investors are unhappy if they feel like they have to be managers.
Mm-hmm.
They actually like the fact that they're investing in people who are doing the decisions more than anything else, and they I'll put in for advice.
That's actually what I was thinking about. Like, so after you got your corporate investors, since they are bigger size, you know, probably a lot of competencies as well. Did you feel they had like a lot of suggestions or tried like to steer your strategy in another way or influence it at least?
To be honest, no. I think from day one it's been very clear, sort of, you know, that, you know, it's a company that we drive and they're investing in that journey.
Yeah.
And they're happy because we are involving them in a lot of decisions for good advice, but we're also telling them where we need their advice and where we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so far so good. things are going well, the metrics are looking good, that makes it easier to have the trust.
Yeah.
And then you get sort of a license to make your own decisions. And it's one of the most important jobs for a founder when you start getting bigger investors in, who are bigger, have bigger shares, to make sure you manage your investors, you manage your board, and it's not the board or the investors managing you. Mm. And the major way of doing that is to draw up the map and tell them, you know, here you can make a decision between A and B, and not here, right?
So that's basically what you did. Like, you were very clear about this is how it's going to work out.
Yeah, and it's a continuous basis. You can say something up front, but it has to be managed throughout. So every board meeting is a part of that, of sort of managing, you know, what are decisions and what are not decisions in this forum, right?
Yeah.
Because the risk is there, and no one wins the moment that you are leaving the driver's seat for the board or the investors. Because no matter how smart those investors or that board is, they're not spending 80 hours a week in your startup.
No,
you
that's
are.
The thing.
So you will know more, you have more context, you'll know more about the customers, you'll know more about the product than anyone else in the world, including your investors. So if you cannot leverage that information to guide, then they will start doubting whether you're the right one.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. For good reason.
So you kind of explain now why you chose to tie your product with these bigger companies. Was there a particular reason for those two, besides the logic that they win if you win? Did you have other corporate investors approaching you, or who positively showed interest?
Yeah, we did have quite a few in both spaces. So both in the food space instead of Dr. Oetker, and in the kitchen equipment space instead of Miele. There's a few things that sort of characterize those two, and it's not something you can see in annual reports or on their webpage or anything, because it's about the people. So it just so happened that in Miele, they have Christian Zangs, who's the guy who's leading their venture capital department, who has become a close friend of mine. He's a very entrepreneurial mindset. He makes things happen. He is a no BS kind of person. and he's a wonderful human being. In Dr. Oetker, there's Tobias Tam, who's super entrepreneurial. Like, he actually... I said no to him and Dr. Oetker like 4 or 5 times, and he convinced me by just being persistent and just showing me what they were doing, learning that how entrepreneurial they can be within the space we're working with. So it was more the people than the company, you could say, and that's what you have to remember. Like, you at the end of the day, you're not working with neither as customers or investors. You're not working with companies. You're working with people.
Yeah.
And that's the core thing, and that's where they were distinguishing themselves from others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So chemistry is really a priority for you when choosing your investors.
Yeah, chemistry and trust. Obviously competence, but I think trust is probably the biggest of those. Again, if you're gonna have keep your autonomy, you need to have people, you trust them, they trust you, or they will use their percentages of the company to steer it in another direction. But if you have trust, that's not going to happen. And if you, so that's the core metric to go by is trust.
We actually talked to Organic Basics, and they also said, sometimes you just don't have a choice. You have to take the money, and you cannot look for that investor that you will trust or that you have good chemistry with. And it seems like in your case, you were able to say no, actually, in some cases. Were you ever in that space where you actually had to take the money from someone you didn't want to? How does that maybe contradiction is lived as a founder?
I mean, it's extremely real, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that I think no matter what I've done in my life, there's nothing I've done that's harder than starting a company and trying to build it. It's freaking hard. Mentally, it's hard. And you have existential sort of fear on a daily basis.
Yes.
Right? So for that reason, you are standing there right next to the wall that will end this all the time in some way or form. Might be mentally, might be actually financially. And for that reason, you can be desperate. I have been desperate as well at times, but I've been lucky so far that sort of I've been able to sort of bluff my way through those times and seem confident. so that it didn't impact negotiations as such. It's not that I've been desperate in some of these situations, but mm-hmm. I've been good enough at bluffing that it didn't feel that way, so it didn't impact terms.
That's very good. And I actually, you write quite a lot on your website. You have a blog where you're sharing quite a lot of your inner thoughts or reflections, which I had a really good time reading to prepare for this. And I read in one of those posts that there was this moment where you realized your burnout rate was actually going a little bit too fast, yeah, and that you would run out of cash before getting the money you wanted to get in. And that included slashing your co-founder's salary for some months. It seems like this is pretty common for startups. Yeah. Do you think...
It happens to me once a year, by the way.
Once a year. It continues happening. But how did that change maybe the dynamic with your co-founder, but also could you have done it any differently, actually?
It's one of those things where you wish you had, hindsight is 20/20, and you wish you knew and that you could make this perfect milestone map where you knew exactly this is when that happens, right? But that's just not the case. Mm. The fact of the matter is, Mike Tyson once said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really how it's like, right? So for that reason, I wouldn't actually look back and say I could have seen it differently. I think the major aspect is, like, if you're running a startup that is doing something new and not just like being, same as that thing over there but in blue, but really making something new, you got to be in trouble at some point during that journey, because there's got to be people not believing you before you have the perfect product, right?
Yeah.
And for that reason, you are going to be in those situations. So it's not about whether you can avoid those situations where you're running out of money in 5 minutes, but it's how you react around it that can make a difference. So I think so far we've been good at taking those difficult situations, had team conversation about it, and making it more of like a galvanizing force, like remembering, we're doing something hard together, we're in the trenches, we're building something great, and that's going to be hard, and there's going to be other hard times too.
Yeah.
It's part of our folklore, our story of this war, and it's more, let's not sit down and just feel like we made it, because we haven't. Mm-hmm. And reminding ourselves of that can be powerful, because it means that we all prioritize the time better. I think we've been managing to do that so far.
You turn it around.
Letting the stress sort of impact our ability to think or be on our toes. But it really is how you manage that situation. It's not avoiding it, I think.
Yeah, I believe in the same thing, but also, how would you suggest founders in similar situations actually maybe preparing, because you already know when you move in to the startup space, you know the consequences, right? You know the risk. But how do you prepare employees, co-founders, investors for these kind of situations?
I think I have a boring answer and a more interesting one. I'm going to start with the boring one.
Yeah.
Contracts, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you put these contracts up that are like, labor contracts, investor contracts, and there are always terms, co-founder contracts, where there are all these terms about what happens if. And you should not have that what happens. First of all, you should invest time in like getting that right.
Yeah.
But second of all, you should have a very explicit conversation about those things that are painful to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if? Mm. Right. Because that, it's good to have the contracts in place, but it's also really important to have had that conversation where you're realizing, we are a startup, so we have a 90% chance of failing. This is a 90% case.
Yeah. Right?
So let's talk
people
about
that. People need to buy into that, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just realize, and the same goes for employees and saying, in most companies, I would not say this. I wouldn't have said this if I hired you in Novozymes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm hiring you in PlanJammer. So when it says 3 months trial period, it actually means a 3 month trial period. And it means that after 2.5 months, you might have to have a conversation about it wasn't the right fit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your fault or mine, but it just wasn't the right fit given the situation we're in. So making those things explicit conversations, because they will happen a lot that you just after 2.5 months cannot hire the person that you hope to hire because of external situations or internal ones. Mm. And then having had the conversation about contracts is important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's core. And then the other aspect of this is managing your own mental state. In this, because it's a whirlwind, right? And if you're not in balance, then people are going to feel it around you, and you know, other employees are going to get panicked and so on. So managing your own health, you know, mental state by, you know, do your exercise, do your meditation. If you do that, if not, then do your meditation.
Yeah. So meditation is a big thing for you.
That's for me personally. Yeah, I need that space, that distance. It could also, some people, I also like to read fiction. That also helps just get your brain somewhere else, right? And be fully present, and that's something else that's super important. Some people get that with a good run, and that's fine as well. But you have to invest in yourself if you're gonna be able to keep it cool and be able to make, you know, those decisions in a human way. Because when you're under pressure, you think you're gonna go bankrupt, and you're pressured, and you've been working 80 hours a week for a while.
Yeah.
You're likely to not sound very sympathetic when you also, you know, have to get rid of a person, right?
Yeah.
So you really have to manage your mental state to stay human and be able to sort of take a step back and do this human.
Yeah, that's such an important message. I think that a lot of founders in general, you know, they just have this great idea. They spend like 110% of their energy, and all of a sudden it's just a burnout, right?
Absolutely.
I think I've said this so much to the team that they actually put it on my birthday cake. it's a marathon, not a sprint. And that really is it, right? Because we're working with important stuff, so we're passionate.
Yeah.
We're working with people that we care and love with. So we obviously are going to be passionate about what we do. So yes, we do kind of want to work, you know, too much.
Yeah.
So we have to stop ourselves because if not, you know, they say it takes 7 years to make an overnight success.
Yeah.
so you're not going to make it like this, right?
No.
You need to be able to have energy for 7 years at least.
That was actually one of your reflections in one blog post, to be or wondering if you were too lazy to succeed, because you were also taking some of that time for your own meditation, for your morning walk or a coffee. And I think you called it this new Nordic maybe way of building a startup. And you wished that maybe it was a thing and that you actually weren't too lazy to succeed. Do you think with this approach you've been successful in both fundraising and building a sustainable business with the perspective you have now?
Absolutely not. I wish I could say, yeah, you know what, I work 9 to 5 and I meditate and run all the time, and you know, I'm going around in a mental bliss, but I don't.
Yeah.
It's a hard journey, and you know, it's also a macho culture. It's a macho culture to say I'm working 100 hours a week and I'm feeling fine. That's macho culture, and that's bad. We don't want to have that kind of culture in startups. That's a mistake. It's also macho culture to say, like, I am in this mental bliss on a cloud and I'm completely fine with the distance, and I can, you know, I don't need to work too much because I work smart and all this stuff. That's also a way of having too much ego in that.
Yeah.
No, it's really hard, and I've worked too hard every week compared to what I should, to be honest, and I try to do something about it, but nevertheless, it is a journey. And it's just, I think we're not doing ourselves a favor if we walk around saying doing startups is just about having a great idea and being smart and then things will happen. It is a huge challenge to not work too much when you're doing this.
Yeah,
it's really difficult. And at the end of the day, you probably are going to work too much and not make the Nordic startup approach that I wish I could have said I have been, but no. Sorry.
But even if you just landed right for 4 million euros, that's a massive investment, and still maybe you're not out of the woods yet with that.
No, not at all. So you know, with you know, with that just comes great expectations of what we're going to build and committing to that, right? So we're definitely not. I would say some would say you're out of the woods when you're cash flow positive, right? But then even when you're cash flow positive, there's many companies who've gone cash flow positive and then gone bankrupt later. So it's not like you're going to... It's again a mental trick you should never go by. You should never think that, oh, once I get over this X, then everything will be fine. And then I'm going to be happy and everything's going to be great. Now you have to just enjoy the moment and say, you know what, it's not going to be, there's gonna be, not going to be this external thing like a funding round that's going to make you more smooth or more happy or stuff like this.
Yeah.
You have to just, you know, enjoy the moment of the battle and the struggle and realize that, you know, it's a long journey. And if you don't enjoy every day working with the friends and the people about something that you're passionate about, then you shouldn't do it. If you think it's something external that's going to make you happy around this, I think that's a mistake. So after 4 million euros in the bank, we're still working hard to survive.
Yeah. have to do something with them now. You have to transform them into,
That's our job.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's fun.
Yes, I hope so.
Yeah, hopefully it is.
Absolutely.
It's important that you enjoy the whole ride.
Yes. Do we have time for one more question?
Yeah, I think we can take a take a last one. In October 2018, so before you got your latest investment, you went through what you call it, which is also known in the startup space as the Valley of Death. So you mentioned that you were getting traction, you were getting users, but still, you know, had troubles generating revenue. So how did you overcome that obstacle, and how did you get through it?
Yeah, so so the Valley of Death is basically the moment many startups are in, where they build a great product, they have people who love the product as well. They might not have found the growth model. That means, you know, that love becomes huge traction and virality.
Yeah.
Or they might not have found the conversion factor to paid or some sort of customer.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you can easily go dead there, even though you created love, which is the first thing you want to create, right, among your users. And yeah, we've been in that one for sure. The way to get around it is obviously to draw up a map of, you know, what does it take to get to cash flow positive? What does it take to get to virality? And you know, do a few tests around that, so you also have data points to show, and then you can bring that to an investor.
Yeah,
because the investor will then say, it's fine, you don't have that now, but I see where you are now, I see all the positive data points here, and I see it on these three experiments where you've shown that you can convert, you know, 5% of your users to this kind of price, and I believe you can do that at scale, and then I also believe in you. So given you have a story that's credible with data points behind it and a team, you know, then you can ask for money.
Yeah. Right?
So it is, there's a bit of storytelling and a bit of testing and making sure that you have your data points, that, you know, proving that story. Mm-hmm. And that's really what investing is, right? Investing is putting money in something that's not profitable now because they need cash. So obviously it's not profitable.
Exactly.
So you need to back that up with what is your journey and what are you going to build?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. I have one. This answer you just mentioned made me think of this reflection that you also had about FACT. I think you call it data-based investment instead of gut feeling investment, which is a McKinsey approach or something like this. I can't remember exactly how you called it. But I'm curious to know whether you ever had to approach an investor who actually didn't share the same worldview as you with this idea of we need more or less meat or people to cook more, and how do you take conversations with people who aren't exactly aligned with what you're building, basically?
I think it's very simple, right? You know, if you... I'm not building a company because I want to have more money on my bank account, because... Then I would not build a company. Then I would start and I would work for a big company.
Yeah.
That's much easier. So I'm building a company because I want to make a difference. There's an impact I want to have on the planet. I think the world needs a product to solve a particular problem. And if an investor doesn't believe that that problem needs solving, then they shouldn't be an investor. If they believe that the product we're building should be solving another problem, I'm not interested. It's not the product that's interesting. It's a problem that we're solving. So if they're only excited about the product but not the problem, it's the wrong employee, it's the wrong investor, it's even the wrong customer, right? So I think it's a pretty simple answer if you find someone who's not aligned with your problem. They can be misaligned with your product and say, it's a crappy product, I think it should be this way. That can be powerful. That can may help you build a better product. But if they think it's a crappy vision, you should stop.
It's not the right fit. Yeah.
The compass is quite clear in that case. Indeed.
It's a good reminder.
That was a pretty obvious answer, maybe.
No, I think it's a good question. I think one because also you can, again, when you're in a desperate mode, you can focus on the wrong investors. It's just super important to say, what is an absolute showstopper here? And an absolute showstopper for an investor is if they don't believe in your vision. So I was actually talking to Jesper Buch at some point. He was very adamant on meat, right? So that's not a conversation.
No.
So we stopped that conversation.
And
I think that's one of those places where you just have to put a line in the sand.
And have that clear from the beginning, maybe in your mind also, right?
Completely. And don't try to hide it. Like, don't say, okay, I'll put it into the third meeting, and by the way, it's plant-based. Like, that doesn't make any make any sense.
Yeah.
If it's what you believe in, it's better to get a quick no.
Yeah, then push it through.
Yeah.
Nice. I think that's it.
Yeah, it is.
We cool. have covered a lot. Thanks for all your answers.
Thank you for
it's been such a pleasure. Trust. And great stories also.
Yes.
So thank you so much.